This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Cincinnati community reacts to the second mistrial in the case against Ray Tensing and waits to hear if he'll be put on trial a third time. And the Ohio legislature passes a $65 billion state budget. Now the question is, will Governor Kasich make any vetoes? Joining us to discuss these and other tri-state stories in the news this week are WCPO.com social media producer Libby Cunningham, race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Kernute, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. Later in the show, we'll hear from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Libby, Mark, and Tana, thank you for being here this afternoon.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Let's start with the case of former UC police officer Ray Tensing. His second trial for the shooting death of Sam DeBose, just like the first trial, ends in a hung jury. And that occurred last Friday, Tana. What was it like leading up to that? What happened?
Well, it was a whole lot of sitting around for 4 days while the jury did their very important work of deliberating. Friday morning came around, the jury came back in, and after about 2 hours, they sent a note to Hamilton County Judge Leslie Giz saying that they were unable to come to a conclusion, So they were brought in and then read, a charge that the jury hears that says, you know, you're never going to hear any better evidence.
Allen charge, right?
An Allen charge, or in Ohio, we have a Howard charge.
Okay.
You're basically saying that you'll never have better evidence. There will never be people who are more
qualified,
thank you, to do the job. And she sent them back to deliberate, and they stayed about through the lunch hour deliberating, and then sent another note saying they were about evenly split in their votes, determining guilt or not guilty. And so at that point, she did accept that and render a mistrial.
Now, Libby and Mark, you were outside the courthouse when the no verdict came down. What were the reactions outside at that point?
So actually, I was inside of the courtroom when
you were in the
came
courtroom.
Down.
Okay.
And you could see the families, both families kind of looking ahead. I think that when you come back 2.5 hours into a courtroom after the jury first says that they aren't able to come to a conclusion like we did with this trial, I think everyone sort of knows what might be coming next. And so everyone in the courtroom was very, very quiet, looking ahead, paying attention, kind of hearing what was going on next. Afterwards, when you came outside of the courthouse, there had been a group of demonstrators that had been there throughout the week, and they had been demonstrating out front and then, of course, trying to see the families exit throughout the courthouse.
Mark, what did you observe?
A lot of rain.
Yeah, that was one thing that was interesting. There was a ton of rain that day. Yeah,
and I think it speaks to the dedication of the demonstrators. I think, again, you're always very careful with crowd estimates, but I mean, there had to be 50 to 60 people out there in the pouring rain, chanting, demonstrating right there on Main Street. And the reaction that I received was one that there wasn't a whole lot of surprise. The longer the deliberations went on, the more likely it was going to be a mistrial, a jury that couldn't come to a verdict. And while there was disappointment, there was immediate determination or expressions of determination of demanding that the prosecutor try him again a third time. And so that it was really almost a quick switch from the disappointment to looking toward a possible or what they wanted to see was a third trial.
Do we know at this point if he is going to try this a third time?
Boy, it's hard to tell. His office said earlier this week that he won't make his announcement until the week of July 10th. So it's hard to tell. I mean, there's all sorts of rumors out there that are, you know, you have to be really careful what you report. But there's an idea that he may go back to a grand jury and come back with potentially lesser charges. But, the people I've talked to think that the charges that were brought the first time were accurate and that maybe negligent homicide or reckless homicide wouldn't be applicable. But I'm not a legal expert, but there is a lot of talk out there about lesser charges or going at it again or a change of venue. So I think a lot of things are up in the air.
And what was the weekend like after this came down?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened, Reverend David Meredith, who is pastor of Clifton United Methodist Church, was part of the group of protesters on Friday. And he is an openly gay man. And he invited Black Lives Matter contingent to march with his church contingent in the Pride Parade the next morning. And so again, there probably were somewhere between 40 to 50 Black Lives Matter supporters and affiliated members of other affiliated organizations who marched. And myself and my colleague, Kara Owsley, a photographer, we marched along with them and were really struck by the positive reception that Black Lives Matter, with their shirts, their chants, received on the parade route.
And things stayed peaceful? No incidents surrounding anything that went on over the weekend?
Very peaceful. And then they had a planning meeting. Countdown to Conviction Coalition had a planning meeting Monday night at the library. And then in less than 48 hours, they turned around their plans for the demonstration Wednesday night outside the FC game.
Now, this coalition, the Countdown to Conviction Coalition, who makes up that coalition?
Well, there's
lots of groups.
There are lots of different groups.
Yeah, you have Black Lives Matter. You have, I'm going to get the name wrong, but the Socialist Student Organization with UC, they one of the main organizers, especially of the rally. And then the Amos Project and
the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition, yes. The Peasley Neighborhood Center. I think Students for Survivors.
Yes, that's right. I think that's
from
an offshoot.
UC. The NAACP.
Yeah.
The NAACP. So yes. They're very proud of the fact that the coalition covers social action, civil rights, the homeless community, and they feel that there is an increasing kind of understanding that, and again, as I just mentioned, the Pride Parade and being in the Pride Parade, that there is an element of a lot of cohesion on social action issues in this area, that the Tenzing issue has kind of brought several organizations together.
Do you think, sorry, I'm going to jump in with a question.
You go right ahead, Tana.
Do you think that dilutes your message in any way when you have so many arms with each having, we're interested in kind of this particular angle, we're interested in this, does that dilute your message?
I'm not sure about that. But the one thing I've noticed, hyper-focusing on Black Lives Matter and the issue of police brutality in the Tenzing case is that the conversation you hear is one of that the issues are very similar, oppression. And it seems that the organizations are willing to, when appropriate or timely, lend their support to the other. And so far, the focus has been, primarily on the issue of police brutality in the Tenzing case.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a demonstration that took place near Nippert Stadium Wednesday night during the FC Cincinnati game. Can you describe that? What was that like?
Go ahead, Libby.
It started around 6 p.m., and I'd say the group continued to grow. Mm-hmm. I think it was the president of FC Cincinnati actually—
Jeff Burden came out, yes.
Came out, gave the group a case of water and said, you're doing a very, very important thing here, before they had started the march. And it had started with—they had been practicing some of the chants that they were going to say, sort of starting a drum circle, and then just—they marched from CCM, I think it is— the whole way to Nippert Stadium and got to sort of on both sides and both entrances.
On the north side of the stadium. And they basically spread out into kind of a long line. They made a point of leaving spaces for people to come through. So they weren't blocking the entrance, but they did want people coming into the game to see them and to hear their message. And then they had a lot of people, a big push, especially as the evening went on and people were showing up for the game, a big push was asking people to sign a petition, asking the prosecutor to have a third trial.
How did the fans react?
I think it was a mixed. All three of us were out there. Mm-hmm. I think primarily it was respectful. One that I think many of the fans understood. I was out there with my colleague Cameron Knight, and they split up into two areas on the north side, and Tana said that on the north side of the stadium. And down there on the south, a whole busload of Chicago fans came off and were coming through with their flag and their chant. And then they joined in the Black Lives Matter chant and they were high-fiving some of the demonstrators. I talked to several of the fans who came up, and while the petitions are largely symbolic and don't have any legal weight, several people, at one point we noted about 10 to 12 people standing in line with one of the petition takers. So I think generally the reception was one that was respectful, at least, or mutually respectful. And I spoke to UC Police Chief Anthony Carter. He was out there with all of the leadership of the UC Police Department and Safety Division. And they were watching everything very carefully and were very pleased with how it unfolded. And then it broke up at about 8:30, you know, well after the game had started.
Are there any more demonstrations being planned?
Yes, I don't know offhand when they are, but my understanding is there are things that are in the works.
There's currently I think they just ended, but they are planning to pick it outside of the prosecutor's office every day every work day until the announcement is made on the retrial or potential retrial. And they had about 20 people that yesterday outside the prosecutor's office on 9th Street. They're going to be having an appearance. They're hoping to have a group marching in the North Side 4th of July parade. And then what I would perceive to be the largest demonstration, we don't have a location yet, but will be Friday night, a week from tonight, July 7th. And I suspect it may be in the Mount Auburn over the Rhine area in some of those neighborhoods, but I don't have any specific details yet. But the sense I get from the coalition leadership is that they want to increase their visibility, not so much have one large public action, but to increase the number of actions, even if some of those are smaller.
And I understand, too, July 6th, the Urban League is going to hold a forum on this as well.
Correct. It's a forum of looking beyond the verdict, and that will be held at the Urban League, I believe, at 6 o'clock up on Reading Road in Avondale, I think 6 o'clock on the 6th.
We will continue our weekly review of news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss Tri-State stories in the news this week are WCPO.com social media producer Libby Cunningham, race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer Mark Kernute, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And let's talk to Bill in the West End. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Yeah, this is Bill Singer. I am a retired attorney. I practiced law in Cincinnati for 47 years until I retired. The criminal justice system in this county, in this state, is so political, and it is hostage to the whims and mouth of Joe Dieters. Joe Dieters never, in my opinion, never saw a microphone or a television camera that he didn't like. What happened in this situation was right after the shooting of Samuel DuBose by Ray Tensing, Dieters appeared on television and called the whole thing asinine, obviously, siding against the University of Cincinnati Police Department, as being, in his mind, apparently, not as professional or well-trained as the Cincinnati Police Department or the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department. In any event,
You think his comments complicated matters.
That news conference caused the University of Cincinnati already to pay out $4.5 million to the DuBose family. And now they still want a murder charge to stick against this young man. First of all, murder is not, I mean...
Bill, so the point you're trying to make, though, is that you think Dieter's comments complicated the whole thing and just muddied the waters. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think Dieter's comments. Dieter's comments are responsible for the continued prosecution of this young man.
Okay, let's let the panelists...
What really should happen
Let's let the panelists comment on this. Thank you, Bill. We appreciate the call. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, that's his job. He's the prosecutor. He decides the charges. So
Do you think that there is a different way that he could have brought this up, or a different way that he could have worded this with getting that same message across?
No, he bring Bill back up again.
Does not decide to prosecute this guy for murder again. That'll be politically inadvisable for him, because what happens is that the poorly educated people who are behind the DuBose family and this whole protest, those folks think that murder is what the charges ought to be. But strictly speaking, what this man is guilty of, if anything, is negligent manslaughter.
Well, so we know, I guess what happens at this point, I think, as Mark was saying earlier, we don't know what the prosecutor is doing now. He could go back to a grand jury and ask for different charges, Mark was saying earlier, or decide the same one. So we'll see the week of the 10th.
Yeah, and we just don't know what's going to happen at this point. Nobody has any inclination as to what Joe Dieters is going to do.
Exactly. And like I said earlier, I'm not a legal scholar, but I did some background, and I mean the two things that keep getting talked about are reckless homicide, which is, you know, you were reckless in causing the death of another person, and that's punishable by 1 to 5 years in Ohio, or negligent homicide.
Negligent homicide come up, and the judge decided that
it was reckless,
and actually wasn't that ahead of the second trial when the prosecutor
that was right after the prosecution rested.
During the second trial,
and the jury was not aware of that.
Right. So what the judge said in ruling, and the prosecution asked her to add reckless homicide to the list of things that the jury could consider. And what she said was her decision was based on two things. One, she said that's not her job. The prosecution, if they wanted that, should have done it from the start. And two, she said anything that she had heard up to that point in the trial did not point to reckless homicide. Of course, the switch there would be that if you are arguing for reckless, you'd be arguing kind of against what you were arguing for with a murder charge. So nothing leading that way would have been brought up.
Let's talk to Kevin in Milford. Hi, Kevin.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on. Go right ahead.
Yes. I was at the rally with my son as a high school student, and we were very impressed with how well organized it was and how respectful it was toward the police. And very clever that it was, I think, trying to confront the public in a sense and get them involved. And I said to him during the rally, I said, if this, and it was also diverse, there was black and white presence there. I said to my son, if it was only African-American, imagine how African-Americans feel living in a society where no one else is supporting this issue or concerned about this issue. And alternatively, the fact that it was mixed, to me, is very hopeful that people are rallying and getting involved in this. And those are my thoughts, and I appreciate the people who organized the rally and did such a good job.
From day one, with my coverage of Black Lives Matter, it has been very diverse racially and very diverse in terms of age. They had a 97-year-old retired doctor marching in front of the prosecutor's office yesterday with them. I mean, I have found Black Lives Matter leadership here to be very well educated, very well thought out, very mindful, very careful in what it does and in what it says. And I know the background of several of their leaders, and they're very well educated. And again, I think there's no accident that the event the other night did draw a very diverse crowd, because people do care about this issue across all kind of racial and ethnic lines.
But July 10th is when we'll know whether there's going to be a third trial or not. That's the
week of the prosecutor's office sent out a release the other day that July 10th is when the prosecutor will announce that week of July 10th is when the prosecutor will announce his decision.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk to Griffin in Northside. Hi, Griffin.
Hi, yeah, I'm a member of Socialist Alternative. We're a member organization of the Countdown to Conviction Coalition, and I just wanted to weigh in on a few things that were mentioned earlier. This notion of education has come up a few times in the conversation. You had a caller that dismissed the protesters as being uneducated. And I think we need to look at that seriously, because I don't think it's necessarily a question of whether people are formally educated, but it's a question of political education a question of whether or not people are going to accept, you know, these routine killings of black people in working class communities. And I think time and time again, we're seeing that from Minneapolis to New York, to Cincinnati with this latest verdict, that black people and working people aren't going to take it anymore, and that we're going to continue to deepen our roots in our communities and build the broadest based coalition so that we can force some energy against the powers that be and hopefully turn the tide against this racist police violence and win justice for working families like the DeBose family.
The DeBose family had even mentioned several times when I had talked to them that they feel that they stand in solidarity with some of these other families who are going through what they're going through, too. It's something that they had brought up a couple of times. The verdict in Minnesota came out the Friday, not the Friday of the verdict here, but the week before. And that was something that they had mentioned, too, that they really feel that they are standing in solidarity with these other families who are sort of in similar situations.
The I think the other thing is, as Griffin just commented, I've been very impressed with the homework that Black Lives Matter and its affiliated organizations, the other organizations in the coalition, have done. When you speak to them, they know case history, they know law, and they've clearly done their homework, and they're very careful. And I'm not taking sides. I'm just telling you what my observations are covering the people who are organizing these demonstrations. But the thing that's really, I think, fueling, I think, is some of the anger and that sense of we're not going to take it anymore is when these shootings happen, you know, with social media and the media being so instantaneous and so immediate, that whether it's outside of St. Paul or in Cleveland or in, you know, Louisiana or South Carolina, they have a sense that they're not far away. They're not like the, you know, 20, 30 years ago where the only place, you know, you not hear about them immediately or see so much coverage of them the way you can today. And the other thing that Black Lives Matter has done is incorporate some in the whole Tenzing buildup, has incorporated, I think some members of the Crawford family have been down from the Dayton area from the Walmart shooting. Mm-hmm. And they've had other people, other mothers, similar to Audrey DeBose, who've lost their children in incidents with police, have come and spoken at rallies. So they're very cognizant of making it bigger than Tenzing, and the Tenzing or the DeBose issue and the DeBose shooting being emblematic of a larger issue. And I think that's been very carefully crafted in their messaging.
Any other thoughts on this before we move ahead? Tana, Union Terminal got some good news this week.
Yeah, they did. They finally got the final piece of their funding pie that they were hoping for. They had applied three times for state historic tax credits to help fund. That was part of the puzzle that they were putting together to fund it. They got some federal ones. And they finally, in their third and last try, they couldn't really
like
apply for anymore.
Like you say in the headline for your story,
yeah,
third time's a charm,
exactly.
Right?
Okay. So the credits came through. They came through at $5 million. They'd asked for $3.25 million. And I just talked to the Museum Center folks. They won't know until the budget gets passed tonight at the state. So we're expecting that to happen, you know, late into the wee hours tonight. Exactly what that means in terms of will it be a full $5 million or what. This will add cushion to their contingency, basically. They were lucky in earlier this year, February maybe, their federal tax credits, historic tax credits, they took those to market and they got about $9 million more, $10 million more than they had expected. So they would have been okay if they hadn't gotten these state ones. But this just adds to the cushion, you know, as they open walls and take walls down and they find new things that need corrected.
Unexpected expenses.
We're about halfway through, and Elizabeth Pierce, the Museum Center president, said she's cautiously optimistic, but doesn't want to, you know, get caught without, you know, with something were to be found that is expensive.
What's the total for this project? Is it?
I believe we're at $219 million
for this.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And still on time and on budget. I double checked.
There was another project, too, that got some good news.
Yeah, the Dayton Arcade. Now, this building, it's actually a collection of five buildings. It's a historic landmark in Dayton, and it's been many things, much like Union Terminal. I think most recently it was sort of a mall. But a historic building that's been around for a long time that people have just loved, but nothing has gone in there. And so I think one man kind of kept it afloat all these years, paying for the upkeep to make sure it didn't fall into complete disrepair. And now it's going to be turned into, they got $5 million in state historic tax credits as well, and that's going to be turned into a mixed-use facility. There will be retail, apartments, or at least some sort of housing. The University of Dayton has signed on to be a tenant. I think Sinclair Community College as well. They're going to come down here and look at Findlay Market, their kitchen innovation programs they have down here, and try and make some of that work up there as well. Lots of exciting stuff going on for a landmark building.
And speaking of exciting stuff, FC Cincinnati.
Listen, I had to eat my words this week, folks. I thought, no way was Chicago Fire going to come down here and lose
to FC Cincinnati. Yeah.
So
that's two MLS teams they've knocked off now, haven't they?
It is. So, you know, exciting things happening in soccer.
Yeah, and this has to be good for them making their case, because one of their objectives is eventually to be an MLS team.
I mean, they're outdrawing some MLS teams right now, and we're talking about second-tier soccer that's being played in a college football campus on turf instead of grass. So, yeah, I think they're definitely making their case when you draw 32,000 people to watch an Open Cup game. And just for some perspective, like an Open Cup game anywhere else is going to draw maybe 6,000 people. This is not a league
match. And the
Open
Cup is where you play between the different leagues, right?
Right, yeah. Okay.
Even amateurs can play in this,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Okay. Libby wanted to jump in.
Libby, yes.
I have seen a really good tweet from my colleague, Keenan Singleton, who is a sports reporter at Channel 9, and he was inside of Nippert, posted a picture, so many people, and he wrote, "Is this Nippert Stadium for FC, or is this the Bren Spence Bridge?" Because there were that many people there.
Well, and then you noted, Tana, that USsoccer.com is now dubbed Cincinnati the capital of American soccer, which is a really cool recognition
for the
city.
Things I never thought I would read.
Yeah, likewise. Well, thank you all for being on this afternoon. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
WCPO.com social media producer Libby Cunningham, race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Cornute, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. Next up, the Ohio legislature passes a $65 billion budget. What's in and what's out? And will Governor Kasich veto any of it? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. And joining me now, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Andy and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Hi.
Andy, Governor Kasich's got until, what, midnight tonight to sign this $65 billion budget into law?
Yeah, he's got around midnight. I mean, when we have these deadlines, I think I've seen the legislature go maybe an hour past the quote-unquote deadline. But yeah, he's got basically until midnight tonight to make a decision of what he wants to do with this bill, what he wants to keep, what he wants to veto. So it's going to go down to the wire. We're going to have a late night.
$65 billion. How many pages did this budget turn out to be?
I counted every single one of them. It was 4,700.
Did you read every single one of them?
No.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really big bill. They had it sitting on the dais of both the House and Senate chambers. It does all sorts of things like all state budgets do. And the big challenge, of course, this year was to fill what started off to look like an $800 million revenue shortfall, and it turned out to be more than $1 billion of a revenue shortfall, and it looks like that they've still balanced it and made up that gap. And of course, the thing we're all looking at right now is the freeze to enrolling people into Medicaid under the expansion population, and it's something that we're all assuming or all predicting that it's something that Governor Kasich's going to veto.
Yeah. Can you explain what that expansion freeze is about? What do they do? They change the levels that you could qualify for Medicaid or?
Right. So while since 2013, people in Ohio could enroll under Medicaid under what was known as the expanded population. And so that's anybody between 18 to 64 years old who's making less than 138% of the federal poverty level. So it's just adding more people into Medicaid. It's something that has enrolled. It's gotten more than 700,000 people in Ohio have health care because of that expanded population. It's a big thing that Governor Kasich has gone on national TV shows to talk about, Medicaid expansion. And leaders in the House and Senate want to freeze enrollment of that starting next year. They're saying we don't want any more people from that population enrolling into Medicaid. And the argument for that is because of everything going on in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate regarding reforming the federal health care laws. They say that they want to freeze it here at Ohio to wait and see what's going to happen with Affordable Health Care Act.
Yeah, I think there's some people who are afraid that what Ohio legislature is doing has kind of gotten lost in the shuffle of all the noise over the federal health care bill that's in the Senate. And, you know, one thing about Governor Kasich, I mean, he went out on a limb to do this in the first place.
To expand Medicaid, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and he had to do an end run around the legislature and go to
the controlling board. Got a lot of criticism for it, and a lot of people opposing him, yeah.
And a lot of people in the legislature were not very happy about it. But, you know, he has stuck to his guns on this. You know, he's insisted that it's not, you know, not under Obamacare, but it is. And, you know, I don't think there's any question. Do you, Andy? I mean, this is going to get a veto, and there's going to have to be override it.
I think for sure this is going to be a veto. And if it doesn't get vetoed, then there's a much bigger story here.
Yeah.
Because this is the thing. This is the reason Governor Kasich is on those national talk shows, right, talking about striking a deal when it comes to the federal health care laws, because so many people in Ohio now have health care because of the Affordable Care Act and because of that expanded population, because of federal dollars coming down. And another thing to keep in mind here is that a huge portion of people who are getting treatment for for opioid addiction, and
right,
trying to,
yes,
fight this opioid epidemic, is coming from Medicaid dollars.
Does this budget that they just passed, what kind of funding does it have in it for dealing with the opioid crisis?
So they appropriated more than $175 million more money to go towards fighting opioids. That includes sending more money to the local level. But as a side note to that, local governments are upset because it handcuffs them more on what they can do with that money. Instead of just sending it to the local level,
yeah,
the state is saying, here's what you do with that money. Some will go to Adam H. Board. Some will go towards raising awareness. Some will go towards treatment. They think it's a step in the Republican lawmakers think it's a step in the right direction, but there are several advocates, more liberal-leaning advocates, who say it's not nearly enough.
Yeah, and a lot of the local governments look at it and say, look, we know what to do with this money. Mm-hmm. You know, just give it to us, and we can handle the problem here at the local level.
Yeah. Does this budget, Andy, cut some of the funding for local government?
It does. It cuts. Not only does it cut the local government fund by, I think it's about $35 million, but it cuts a lot, and this is going back to filling that revenue shortfall, it cuts a lot of different funds, money that's been sitting in pots to help innovation, to help systematic changes for local governments. It takes all that money away from those different funds. So there are different Appalachian resource funds that are no longer there. And like I said, there's this local government innovation fund that helps governments find a way to become more efficient. That fund is now gone too.
Andy, Governor Kasich's proposals about raising certain taxes, you know, sales tax and tax, basically sin taxes, and fracking, that was all dead on arrival, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right when he announced his budget this year, a lot of the different tax changes that he proposed were the things we've seen for the past four or 6 years now. And there were things that have always found a large opposition in the House and Senate. So when he proposed expanding and broadening the sales tax and raising the tax on fracking, that's been one of his big issues. It was
combined
pretty
with an
well
income,
known that that wasn't going to go anywhere.
Combined with an income tax cut.
Combined with, yeah, correct.
Now, the income tax cut that he proposed, though, didn't survive this budget, didn't make it into this one, did it?
Right.
Yeah, but
a lot of these bigger changes that he proposed were quickly pushed to the wayside, especially when it was looking as if the budget, you know, the estimates that were coming in were falling well short of what they were expecting. And so a lot of these changes that they wanted to do had to be pushed to the side because they just needed to slash funds.
Andy, obviously, the Democrats are a distinct minority and didn't have a whole lot to say about this. But was there ever any real discussion about using the rainy day fund money to deal with this
the rainy
hole
day
in the budget?
Yeah, the rainy day fund is a really interesting topic because there are a
and how
lot
big
of,
has that gotten, Andy?
It's more than two billion. Yeah, and so I mean, for example, the Senate Democrats came out with a plan a few months ago saying let's pull $100 million from the rainy day fund. So. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, $200 million, so 10% of the rainy day fund, and put it towards the opioid epidemic. And that was one of their big things that say this that we call this the rainy day fund. Well, it's raining here in Ohio with this opioid epidemic. Let's dip into it. It's always been a non-starter for the governor for touching that money. That money is specifically there for very specific economic reasons, and it's pretty non-negotiable for him.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And I apologize if I get this wrong. Is it Maria?
Mariah.
Mariah. Hi. In Liberty Township, go right ahead.
Hi. So I'm an educator, and I know, Andy, you have an educator close to your heart. what's the bill look like for teachers, schools, students?
So there were about 500 and so of the 600 plus school districts that are in Ohio, about 540, 550 school districts either saw their budgets increase or saw their budget flat. So no decreases to those. So about 70 school districts saw a decrease to funding. There weren't many changes regarding education. As you probably know, that there were some proposed changes. For example, the governor wanted to make it a requirement that if a teacher wanted to renew their license, that they had to go do an internship with a local business. That's out of the budget. That's been out of the budget for a while now. And those other policies, such as having some non-voting members, requiring non-voting members in the school board that are from local business groups, that's also out of the budget. But a lot of other things that were proposed and some funding changes did not make it through the process.
Now, the Medicaid expansion freeze, one thing that we feel pretty certain that Governor Kasich will probably more than likely veto at this point. Are there any other things in there that do you think he might veto, Andy?
That's a good question.
Hard to say because he's not really saying anything.
No, and he's pretty good. Usually he's really good at saying, I'm going to let the legislature do their thing. I'm not going to comment on anything. But it's pretty apparent that the Medicaid expansion freeze enrollment, that's going to not make it. Nothing that comes to mind of other big ticket items that he might veto. There was a utility provision in there at first. It would have allowed utilities to charge extra fees on electric bills in order for those utilities to get a better credit rating. That was something that I thought maybe the governor would have vetoed, but that was taken out before he even had a chance to.
Yeah, we're going to assume that he's going to veto the Medicaid portion, but what do you think the chances are of an override?
So that's where I think the fun drama starts to come into play here, because the House and Senate want to show their strength here because the governor has vetoed several of their bigger policy changes now, and they want to show that they're not chambers to be messed with. So the budget passed
especially
in the House.
Especially by a lame duck governor.
Right, correct. And somebody who's been very outspoken against the president of their own party right now, too.
Right.
So the budget passed the House with 59 votes. The House needs 60 votes in order to override a veto. And so by that logic, they would need to just get one more person to vote for the freeze. But there's going to be a lot of people out there who would say that they voted for the budget, but they did not like the freeze. So I think it's about convincing a few more, maybe a handful more people to actually vote to override the governor here.
So it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be a
It's not going to be easy. Right. The Senate passed it with 24 votes, and they would need 20 to override. So it seems like the Senate might be in a little better position, but I think the real question is where the House is at.
Mm-hmm.
Howard, the race for Ohio governor, that's been quite interesting this week. We've seen it start to heat up a bit here. What's the latest on this?
Well, the latest, I guess, was Vice President Pence coming to the suburbs of Cleveland. And he brought with him Jim Renacci, one of the candidates for governor, Republican candidates for governor, who apparently seems to be the person who is the closest to the Trump administration, to the Trump political machine, and is campaigning basically as a Trump supporter. And these other candidates, the Mike DeWines, the John Husteds, the Mary Taylors, are establishment figures, and he represents the kind of change that Trump talked about during the campaign, and Trump won Ohio. So, you know, he's latching onto that in order to try to win in a crowded primary field. Mike DeWine, last Sunday at his annual ice cream social at his home in Cedarville, announced formally that he is running for governor. We've known this for at least 4 years
Ten
now.
Years.
Yeah, right. That he was going to run for governor.
So no surprise.
Yeah. So it's no surprise that he actually became a formal. And he went out on a tour of the state, including a stop in Cincinnati, which is what announced candidates do. And you know, that race is game on now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, who else is on the Republican side?
Well, you've got the four of them. You've got
four people, so you've got... Yeah.
You've got Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor.
Okay.
Right. John Husted.
Like you said.
Yeah. John Husted, the Secretary of State. Jim Renacci, the congressman.
Okay. And of the four, Andy, do you think that the DeWine, because of his career in elected office, I think it spans, what, four decades? You think that makes him the front runner in this case?
I think he's definitely the front runner in this case, not because of anything other than name recognition
now.
He's the one that everybody knows about, and I've said this for a while now. Last year at the Republican National Convention, Mike was standing on the convention floor, shaking everybody's hands, saying hi to everyone he knows. He just knows these people. He knows the right people to know when it's time to run statewide for governor for the Republican Party. So he's just got this establishment advantage. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have Secretary of State John Husted, who has a lot of energy. He has some momentum. He's got a lot of organization. His campaign's well organized. So I think he can mount a big challenge. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor has the title of Lieutenant Governor and the backing of John Kasich. So that's what she has going for her. And like we said, Renacci has this whole Trump factor. And I think the question here is, does appealing to Trump voters or having that quote unquote Trump factor, will that get you anywhere in an Ohio gubernatorial race?
That's the question. That is the number one question to this thing. Is that going to make a difference? Now, you know, Trump not only won Ohio last fall, but then after the election, his people came in and basically took over the machinery of the Ohio Republican Party. They threw out the chairman, Matt Borges, who was an ally of John Kasich, who never, ever endorsed Donald Trump for president and has, you know, stayed clear of him. And now, you know, the Trump people basically run the machinery of the Ohio Republican Party. I think it's going to be a matter of the voters, Republican primary voters. Do they look at it and just say, okay, well, Mike DeWine, he's a known commodity. He's been around. He was the United States Senator for two terms. He was congressman. He was lieutenant governor. He's been, you know, everything down to Greene County prosecutor. And do we just vote for the familiar, or do we go with somebody new, somebody different, and somebody that is tied directly to Donald Trump, Jim Renacci? I would not be surprised in the least to see Trump get personally involved in this campaign, in this primary campaign, in one way or another. I mean, it came very close to it with Vice President mm-hmm. Pence the other day up in Cleveland, you know, where he was talking about, you know, what a great friend Jim Renacci was and how he'd known him, you know, even before he was in Congress.
And I think that if Renacci painting himself as a Trump Republican is going to work, mm-hmm. I think that it has to be the president actually coming to Ohio and endorsing him and doing a rally or two. Exactly. I don't think it's going to work out any other way for him unless that happens.
Right. And it might be smart for a candidate, and I think Mike DeWine is probably smart enough to figure this out, that it might be best to just kind of keep your distance and not talk about Donald Trump a lot, talk about the other issues, the Ohio issues, and let the other three fight over the Trump voters and take those more moderate establishment-type Republican votes, and you end up winning because the Trump vote will be split three different ways. But as Andy says, if Donald Trump comes into Ohio and starts personally campaigning for one of these candidates, and it would be Jim Renacci, then it might be a different game altogether.
Who's running on the Democratic side, Andy? They have four as well, I think, at this point.
Yeah, you have four as well. You've got former Senate Minority Leader Joe Schiavone of the Youngstown area. You've got former State Representative Connie Pillich of the Cincinnati area. Let's see. You've got former Congresswoman Betty Sutton, and then Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley.
Right.
So you've got those four going too, and it seems like all four of them have been putting out their campaign. It seems like Whaley and Sutton seem to be getting a little more momentum as far as press coverage goes and as far as just getting their word out there a little bit more, but it's still a long way away from the primary.
Yeah, Whaley has been very high profile and has done things, you know, to try to get her name out there, you know, after Mike DeWine filed suit on the behalf of the state of Ohio against pharmaceutical companies for overprescribing or pushing doctors into overprescribing. She jumped on and said, hey, this doesn't go far enough, so the city of Dayton is also going to sue the pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. She is very, very proactive. She is, you know, kind of a new generation of Democratic politicians in this state, as is Connie Pillich to a certain extent. But Whaley is, I think, the one to watch.
Andy, how are the other statewide office races shaping up?
Well, we just had a little bit of news this week where we found out that two Democrats had filed for some down ticket races. So you have former Congressman Zach Space, he has officially filed to run as auditor. He has not made an official announcement whether he's going to or not. And then you have Rob Richardson of the Cincinnati area, who is, again, thinking about running for treasurer. He has filed the correct paperwork, but he says he's still exploring it at this point.
Yeah, and there are other potential candidates on the Democratic side for both of those positions. And also on the Republican side, you've got people, you know, who are lining up to run for those positions.
Andy and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow and WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Cincinnati Edition celebrates its fourth year on the air this week. We're marking the occasion by asking you to tell us how we're doing. Are we providing discussions on the issues and topics you want to hear? Are we presenting the information you need? What can we do to make the show better? Please let us know. Email us at talk@wvxu.org. And to our many guests and to everyone who listens, thank you. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.